Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 9 and 11 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show. Good morning. Welcome to Counter Stories. It's our favorite time of the day to discuss our segment, By People of Color, For People of Color, and Everybody Else. My name is Luz Maria Frias, President and CEO of YWCA Minneapolis.
Don Eubanks, Associate Professor at Metropolitan State University and Social Work Program, and Cultural Consultant.
And I'm Brant Williams. I'm a correspondent here at Minnesota Public Radio News.
Our good friend Anthony Galloway is under the weather today, so wishing him some well wishes there. Mm-hmm. And we're also missing Lee, who is off doing some worldly travel and excited about that. And in her stead, we have a guest. May, do you want to introduce yourself?
Sure. Hi, everyone. My name is May Esperanza Los Loso. I'm a community organizer and activist.
Welcome, May. And you're a little familiar with our program, right?
I am. So I know Lee and Anthony personally, and good. I enjoy the program.
Awesome. Well, great to have you. Mm-hmm. Let's just jump right in. Mm-hmm. So quite a bit of news to talk about. And, of course, one that is dominating the airways, and I would say social media as well, is the issue of the big game between Serena Williams and Naomi Osaka, and the exchange that occurred between Serena and the umpire, and the penalties that he then issued during the game, which were unfair. I think there's a big consensus that is growing on that from both male veteran tennis players as well as female veteran tennis players. And the nuances there that not only is it sexist, but also racist. So we can jump into that. And I know over the course of the years when I've been a tennis fan, John McEnroe comes to mind, you know.
Oh, yeah.
And his... it almost seemed like his calling card,
his
if
outbursts.
You will. His,
John McEnroe was the bad boy.
And that what he's known for and was accepted. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like I said, it was his calling card. Cursing, using profanity towards the umpire or the referee for that matter, and doing so at a level that could be audibly heard on the television when it's captured by the camera. And then also Andres Agassi, you know, who had also used a number of expletives during the his different games and was labeled by the media as a rebel rather
even
than
did commercials for Canon cameras, the Canon Rebel. That was him.
That's right. Yep. That's right. Mm-hmm. Good memory. But yet, as we see the coverage unfold and the headlines associated with Serena, you know, the words and the captions that I saw referred to her behavior as being hysterical and having a tantrum, if you will, as well. And here she's relaying certainly her emotion and being upset and being labeled hysterical as a result of that. But yet, for the male players, they've been outspoken or rebels. So, you know, just the framing of it by the media certainly perpetuates that divisiveness between the genders. Mm-hmm. And stereotypes as well. But, you know, we also think about how the stereotypical black woman is viewed in the U.S., largely, and then across the world and the stereotypes that extend, as the angry black woman. And one of the most offensive things that I've seen along those lines, again, in social media, was a cartoon that was on the front page of a Melbourne newspaper, which is mm-hmm. the largest readership newspaper in Australia was just a horrific...
Can you describe that? Because I hadn't seen that.
So their cartoonist drew a picture of Serena basically looking like a Hulk figure, if you will, really, really big and disproportionately masculine with a minstrel face. And so she is, in that cartoon, having, you know, a fit, if you will, like slamming down and showing the anger. On a tennis court and across the net is purportedly Naomi Osaka communicating with the umpire, and Osaka has a blonde ponytail.
Yeah, she's totally whitewashed.
A blonde ponytail.
That was very unusual as well.
So when folks are saying this is not about race, what is it about then? I mean, how do you completely distort the fact? I mean, you look at Naomi Osaka, who's Haitian and Japanese. She does not have blonde hair. I mean, that is factual, right? Let's jump in. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think, I mean, she's been in the news a lot, right? Being the youngest player to win. But I saw an interview that she did actually with media afterwards, and she seems really frustrated that she has to explain her identity every media event that she has to do and really go through the entire story of, you know, this is where my parents are from and I train in the U.S. And I can see that being frustrating. You know, even for me, I am always kind of misclassified. You know, no one can ever pronounce my name exactly right.
And how do you self-identify?
So I self-identify as a Filipino American, and growing up on the west side of St. Paul, where there's a large, you know, Latino population, people talk to me in Spanish or Hmong, because I'm like kind of an enigma. You know, people are not sure. Filipinos are kind of a different group than in the neighborhood, I guess. So, I mean, even having to explain my identity kind of constantly, I see a little bit of that, I guess, in kind of what she has to deal with.
Well, I mean, so I'm born and raised here, and I'm Native American and African American, and I have dealt with that intersectionality of those two my entire life in a community that, while the Twin Cities is becoming much more diverse, you know, 60-some years ago, when I was a little boy growing up, and now it was even more homogenous in terms of European Americans, and have had to, you know, often people will, once they work up the nerve, will come up and ask me what I am. And then depending on how I feel that day, it depends on what kind of answer I give them, because it doesn't really matter. But, you know, Luz, you brought up so many different things that we can discuss.
Right. Jump right in, buddy.
Well, I mean, you know, so because for me, you know, early in my career, I worked in the area of I worked at an organization called the Fathers Resource Center, providing support for fathers, parenting classes. But most importantly, one of the intersection of the work that I did at that time was trying to help fathers and men overcome the genderization process that we all go through as men in this country, which starts as soon as you're born. So as soon as you're born, and when you leave that hospital, young baby boys are sent home in what, usually?
Yeah, blue.
A blue blanket, and young girls are sent home in
pink.
A pink one. So we begin that genderization process.
And interesting factoid, I don't want to sound like the guy from Cheers right now, but I'm feeling like him,
Norm,
was that in the early 1900s, actually, blue was a girl's color, because it was seen as kind of more subtle and more calming. And then the garment industry actually flipped that later on. But it's interesting, you know, that some folks are relying on the blue as masculine when it, that hasn't always been the case.
Sure.
Over the course of history.
But the idea, however, is that we start that genderization process. And from that point on, young boys and young men receive the same type of message. The same message as I receive. We mm-hmm. don't cry. The message we receive is that whatever a woman is, we're the opposite. Mm-hmm. We're to be strong.
And you're rewarded for right. showing
exactly.
aggression and for showing your, strength.
All the young boys that you grew up with reinforce that for yep. you when you're out in the park playing. You know, I can remember often being in the park playing boys are boys. That common theme, yeah. boys are boys. When you were describing John McEnroe and Agassi, I forgot about Agassi.
Yep.
Right? But when you brought those names up, the first thing that came to my mind is the same message we received as young men, boys will be boys. And then that behavior is excused.
Well,
and I'm not, you know, I'm not saying to justify it. I'm just
right,
saying
right.
that's well, how it's reinforced.
And the mm-hmm. irony of that is, so from what you're sharing with us is that boys are taught to suppress their emotion.
Yes.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
but
yes.
then you explode. You know, grown mm-hmm. men are exploding.
Well, that's an acceptable arena for men to show emotion, right? Is
right.
sports and being emotionally and showing and having it come out as anger and aggression.
Right.
That's acceptable emotion for young boys. And tennis players like, you know, John McEnroe and Andre Agassi. I mean, if they cry, imagine what would happen if, you know, John McEnroe broke down and cried after losing a match.
Yes.
Imagine what kind of blowback he would have gotten for that.
Well,
you know what I mean? And Serena is like one of these sports figures who is, I mean, she's kind of making a breakthrough in these areas where she's coming out aggressive. Serena serves balls over 100 miles an hour. She's mm-hmm. one of the first female tennis players that I can remember seeing serving a ball over 110 mm-hmm. miles an hour. Mm-hmm. And she's like, you know, aggressive in her ground strokes and hitting the ball, you know. And so it's like all of a sudden people have to think, you know, start to rethink how women tennis players are supposed to conduct themselves. I think that she's like starting to, because for her competitors to keep up with her, they have to match her in that respect. They have to adapt, right?
They have to adapt.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. So, but I think everybody else has caught up to her though, as we're seeing, you know, like with this past weekend,
yeah.
how people couldn't handle, you know, her being an aggressive and speaking out and defending herself.
And see, and I agree with you, but it's not limited to this instance. In my mind, we can also think about earlier this summer when she was banned from wearing the catsuit by the French Open mm-hmm. Sports Folk.
Yeah, yeah.
The association.
The association, yeah. thanks. Mm-hmm. Where she, you know, sure, she said it was kind of a Wakanda type of tribute, you know, black empowerment.
Yeah.
But medically speaking, I mean, she had a horrific birth, had a life-threatening episode of blood clots afterwards, and that suit actually had a medical benefit to it and purpose yeah. to wearing it is, again, the issue of being a black, strong woman, a part of this in a way that, you know, it's we talk about implicit bias, we talk about unconscious bias, one and the same, that is undergirding this stuff. I mean, here's a woman who grew up in Compton, who is and we all know Compton, the stereotypes, but also some of the realities of the difficulties in living there in terms of poverty and other challenges. Mm-hmm. So she, against all odds, right, she exceeds expectations and she shatters those expectations at the same time, redefines the area of tennis, just like you're saying, Brandt, earlier. But yet, the system, if you will, that largely governs it is unwilling to accept her for who she is.
And there's a lot. Well, from what I've been reading about a lot of the conflict came during that match is that I've heard tennis professionals and folks in the know say, you know, look, there's no standards, there's no written rules about what words you can or can't say to a referee, an umpire. So by calling him a thief, by, you know, taking a point away from her. Mm-hmm. There's no handbook that says you can't say that to an umpire. So there's a lot of subjectivity there.
Yeah.
So it relies on the personal mm-hmm. views of the officials that are officiating a match. So and that opens up, you know, for people to have their own biases or whatever problems they may have that they bring to officiating this event, and then they get faced with a situation where Serena's getting irate with them, and so they're like, "Well, you're penalized for this," you know.
So in that reading, there's a player that I read about, James Blake. He's a retired, well-known player, and he admitted his own behavior and conduct and use of words was worse than what we heard from Serena. And he said the umpires typically, in his matches and matches of other male players, will give what's called a soft warning and not penalize the player. And this was not...
James Blake is an African-American man, too.
Is that right?
Yes,
okay,
he is.
Thanks for sharing that.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like, you know, I can't help but think this is that intersection where you know, sexism and this whole image of what supposedly what women are supposed to look like when they're out there performing, you know, we have these old antiquated ideas. And any woman that steps up and challenges that, rightfully so, gets hammered. And you know, so that was my reaction when I heard about the discussion with her wearing a one piece, even though I've never even seen it. Wakanda? Well, power to her, you know?
Well, and to your point, I would say, too, is the objectification of her body. And that it was too revealing. She was all covered up.
Yes.
Yeah.
She was completely covered up.
And didn't all this just happen this summer, too? I mean, it seems like tennis is having a hard time dealing with these issues.
May, I wanted to go back to, you know, the conversation we were having earlier about Naomi Osaka's heritage and the fact that she's Haitian and Japanese, and some of the observations that you've had, and we were talking a little bit before coming on air on that. You want to share some of those?
Yeah. So actually, I lived in Japan for 3 years after college, and Japan is very homogenous. You know, they have a word for foreigner, and it really means like an outside person. So it's really interesting, I think, to see someone like Naomi Osaka, you know, in the headlines. And there was another pageant contestant from Japan, I don't know how many years back, who is making a name for themselves, and kind of seeing the identities evolve in the country is, I think, a really huge thing, because it's, you know, I lived in a very small town, and even though I present, you know, Asian, when I start speaking, then they're like, oh, what's wrong with you?
Because
you're an American. But, you know, it was just confusing because I didn't have yellow hair. And blue eyes would be a typical, you know, American to them.
Right.
So just seeing the diversity that's coming out of Japan, I mean, I think that's challenging a lot of norms in the country.
I thought it was striking, too, with Naomi, that her, I mean, here she is. She's the first Japanese American, which she identifies. Apparently, I understand she identifies more as Japanese than like Haitian. But that she's achieved this, and you know, after this very tumultuous match, she is kind of left, you know, everybody's paying attention to Serena.
Right.
And to Serena's credit, I mean, she, at the end of the match, she said, look, let's pay more attention to right now. This is Naomi's moment.
Yep.
Yeah. She's you know, won this championship. Let's, you know, give her due as a champion. I think that was warranted, I think, because it was. This is a young, very young woman. We said she's 20 years old.
Right.
And she's beaten the best tennis player, I would say, ever.
Greatest of all time.
Greatest of all time, yeah. Definitely Serena is the greatest of all time when it comes to that. So, and she's now beaten this woman, and everybody's now paying attention to this spat between Serena and the umpire.
Right.
So
you had mentioned a word, you know, that the Japanese use for outsiders. And when I was doing my readings, I ran into a word that I'd heard before, but I couldn't remember. And it's, am I pronouncing correct, hafu?
Yeah. It means half.
Half. Mm-hmm. Literally, it means half. And so this is another word that is, it's a label that's used by Japanese in a not very positive way, right? So that
pretty derogatory.
Right. So you're not pure Japanese.
Yep.
You're half.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's biracial, with, you know, Japanese and Irish mm-hmm. or Japanese and African American.
Right.
The woman that you talked about, mm-hmm. Miss Universe, that mm-hmm. was 3 years ago. Mm-hmm. And when she was crowned, she's African American and Japanese. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of pushback, and I yeah. remember this.
Pushback from where?
Japanese.
By Japanese.
Saying that she didn't look Japanese enough. They wouldn't say because she had black skin.
Wow.
And then fast forward now, there was rumblings before Naomi Osaka got to this point mm-hmm. that she wasn't pure. I mean, you know, that she was a hafu. And so not really accepted because of her skin color and because her father is Haitian. Mm-hmm. So here's a girl, now a woman, mm-hmm. who was born in Japan, who then immigrated to the U.S. at age 3, I want to say, raised in the U.S. as an American. And her mm-hmm. Japanese, from what I understand, she can understand it better than she can speak mm-hmm. it, which is not unusual,
right?
You know, given the fact that she's grown up most of her years here in the U.S. as an American.
So let me ask you, Luz, mm-hmm.
but,
and May mm-hmm. also.
Yeah.
So you mentioned you were mm-hmm. Filipino. Mm-hmm. Is there a word in your language that describes a similar type of intersectionality of someone who would be Filipino and something else?
That's an interesting question because I don't think we have a word. But Filipinos in general are really mixed. Already.
Anyways,
yeah,
right?
Really mixed, you know, Chinese, Malay, indigenous, you know, it's, who knows?
It's interesting because in my social media feed, this past summer, there's, in the American Indian community, there's discussions going on. And if I was to preface it a little bit, you know, I've talked a little bit often on here on this program about historical trauma.
Right.
Particularly as it relates to the experience of indigenous populations, American Indians, what we call. And the impact of that is that the policies that were put in place that created the boarding schools as mm-hmm. a direct effort to break our culture by taking our kids and sending them away and teaching them white European way of life and not their own.
Mm-hmm.
And all these other things, taking the land, killing us, the whole nine mm-hmm. yards, was successful, and our communities are suffering mm-hmm. as a result of that. As we're still here, we survived all those efforts to eradicate us. We're still here, but we're recovering.
Mm-hmm.
But even in our community, there's discussions about people who are full or people who are half.
Mm-hmm.
Full breeds or half breeds right. are the terms that we use in our community. And while there's no definitive answer, I pay attention to those mm-hmm. discussions because I am half Native American and pretty much half African American, mm-hmm. but I'm a mixture. I'm Heinz 57. My dad told me that on his side, you know, we have some German Jew and I'm
so
part Irish.
Would the word be half-breed?
Half-breed is the term that we
wow.
that
yeah.
we kind of use in the American mm-hmm. Indian. Now, mm-hmm. I don't know, you know, it may be every... But I know in our language, mm-hmm. there's no term.
And
what I mean by Anishinaabe,
yeah.
I believe there's no term. I've never been told by an elder mm-hmm. that there's a term that we had that spoke or described anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
The terms we have that we use for other individuals, like Europeans, was Chumukamat. But Chumukamat actually is describing a long knife, which is what the hunters and the fur trappers carried mm-hmm. were these long knives. And the term we used for African-American was Mukadewias. But Mukadewias is kind of describing the mane of a buffalo. So it was the oh, hair of African-Americans that reminded them of okay. the mane of a buffalo.
Right.
So our language tends to be descriptive mm-hmm. when we speak
so,
English.
Yeah.
How about
so,
in
ours, we... Yeah, we really don't. I mean, there's that connotation would come in. We're talking about indigenous Mexicans, mm-hmm. Certainly, but we don't have that terminology and that derogatory type of connotation. You know, if we think about the word hafu, and May, you said mm-hmm. this earlier when you were in Japan, it was very homogeneous.
Mm-hmm.
So in my mind, Naomi Osaka and the other folks that we mentioned who are hafus are now challenging Japan to reassess who a Japanese is, right? Yeah. There's and the actually, cultural identity.
There's actually a project called, I think it's called Hafu. It's a portrait kind of essay collection of all different kinds of people who are hafu. And it's from all over the world, like different countries represented, and they talk about their stories. So I think there is a movement to make this population more visible and, you know, really focus on that intersectionality.
So so to really get away from that racial purity,
right,
to really then embrace the fact that a Japanese doesn't have to be pure 100% Japanese,
yeah,
and that the lineage can go in various.
Because I was going to bring that, I mean, I was going to mention that. So do we think that, that those type of issues tend to be culturally egocentric, you know, or because when... You know, when I think about the terms that we use in our American Indian community, half-breed, another common theme I've heard is there's a difference between the hang-around-the-fort Indian and those who didn't. And so when you put those in context, those all tie back to traumatic events when they were rounding us up off the land and relegating us to reservations. Was this process, this loss of life, or loss of a way of life, and some individuals knew or felt like, you know, we're either going to die or we have to go along, and then others continued to fight for their freedom. And so it's those traumatic events that these descriptions begin to come about in our community in terms of those who were succumbing and going to the res, hang around the fort, and those who weren't. And so and so, you know, so when I think of these terms in our community, in my mind, I'm convinced they were born out of traumatic events.
Well, and being colonized, right?
Exactly.
It's just, it is. And May, I wanted to close the loop on your experience in Japan. Did you see that discrimination towards hafus?
I did, actually, in person. So I worked in public schools. And so there are a number of Filipinos that have moved to Japan. You know, it's nearby. There's opportunities. And then some folks decide to stay. But typically the Filipinos that work are, you know, work at night. So they work at the bars. They kind of are hostesses, if you will. And so there was a young student, and the teacher actually pulled me aside and was like, oh, that student is half Filipino and, you know, half Japanese. And they knew I was Filipino, so I think they were trying to give me a heads up, but it was very much in a, why did you need to pull me aside to point out this one student? You know what I mean? And typically, kids who are half, they, even if they have a parent that speaks English very well, they kind of dumb down their ability to speak English in order to fit in. Because culturally, you know, it's the nail that sticks out needs to be hammered down type of mentality. So being half, you know, they don't want to stick out as very good at English.
Well, I wonder if, you know, coming back to Naomi and her role as, you know, she may be cutting edge at, you know, and I have seen, I'm actually quite interested in Japanese culture, and you know, I've seen photo essays of young people in Japan who are like really trying to, like, the whole idea of having the nail that sticks out needs to be hammered down. Their kids were trying to stick out even further in the way they dress and the way the music they listen to, and I just wonder if maybe we're going to see, you know, Naomi sticking out as a role model to Japanese youth to stick out even more and pursue, you know, whatever goals that they want to achieve and not worry about how they look or who they
to own,
you know,
their identity.
Exactly. Yeah.
All of their identity.
That might be, all of it. Yeah.
And I'll just say all of their identity, because I mean, we talk about, you know, half this or half that. I mean, I think there's a resurgence, and personally, I'm trying to work on my language and say, I'm this and this, you know, I'm 100% Filipino and I'm 100% American, you know, both of those things can exist. And it's not 50-50, you know, it's 100-100.
To that point, actually, there's been quite a bit of write-ups where it has, you know, the pendulum goes one way, right. You know, to the extreme where people only ask her about her Japanese background and don't ask her about her Haitian background.
Sure.
And she has had to call that out now a number of times and say, wait a minute. I'm also very proud of my Haitian background because if you can begin to think that the Japanese are proud of her, imagine all the folks in Haiti who are thinking about this 20-year-old superstar who's taken the world by a storm, and we're not seeing that narrative.
And
play
I think that's indicative of the times we're in. We're coming to a point where people feel more free to self-identify and to, you know, define themselves instead of being, you know, trying to fit into a box. They say, no, I'm this and that, and I'm both and, and very much, you know, because I, in some cases, and I've heard this from folks, friends of mine who are biracial, multiracial, who have a parent who is of one, you know, ethnic identity and a parent from another group. They don't feel like they're rejecting one of those parents. You know, it's like, no, I'm both and. I'm not rejecting, you know, I may look a certain, you know, my skin color may be brown, but I also identify as white because my mother is white or something like that. Well, or I don't run away from that. I accept it and embrace it.
The U.S. and its system, whether it's the education system or the census system, have perpetuated that, indoctrinated us to have to choose if you are biracial, to have to choose when you're enrolling in school, which of the two, and I know my girls would constantly struggle with that, and I say, you know, check all the boxes. Well, Mom, I'm breaking the rules. That's okay. Check all the boxes. You know, this is not about you denying any part of your heritage, whether it's your father's or mine, in that.
Prior to us being able to check more than one box, and we were only forced to pick one. So that meant I always had to pick either Indian, American Indian, or African American at that time. I don't think we were using black at that time. I would always check other. And then I would write 220. And if anyone looked at that and they asked me why, I would say 220 because a 440 is too far in terms of race. It was a race. I was being, but I always rejected that self-identification. You know, and the history of racial divisiveness in this country, and we can trace that back to that one drop rule. You know, so where depending on, you know, if you were African American in one state, like Florida, for instance, according to theirs, to their definition, they might have if you were more than a half, you were considered black, but you could leave that and be less than that and not be considered. But if you move to Georgia, they might, and I'm not quite, I don't remember which state has a one drop rule, but then you, because of you were one drop, you were black. So what you legally were depended on what state you lived in, on whether you were considered black or not.
And what society wanted to deem him to be as well. So kind of closing the loop on this, I mean, clearly, you know, we've talked about the commonality in terms of the sexism and the double standard there, the racism in terms of who Serena is and how she's being held to a different standard, irrespective of the other, you know, examples that we have shared with other players. And the commonality there is the oppression, right? Whether the oppression in terms of gender or oppression over race. The other big headline, if you will, in the last couple of days is that of the shooting and killing of Botham Jean in Dallas. And we know bits and parts because that is still unraveling as we speak. But what we know, and the little that we know, is disturbing. He's a gentleman who's sitting in his own apartment in the evening. The door then is open, and there are conflicting accounts. One that I read was that the door was slightly open, and that the off-duty officer, after working a long day, walked through, saw him, exchanged a warning.
Issued some commands.
Issued some command, and then shot and killed him. But then
turned on the light and realized she was in the wrong apartment.
But so that's though where things tend to be really messy.
Yes.
In terms of facts. If you read more and more, in newspapers and certainly on social media, there are clues as to why, we talk about dissonance and what the narrative is when it comes out on these police-involved shootings, that there's a truth and there's the truth. And parts of this begin to kind of come together softly and bits and pieces, the first of which is that he had a red carpet mat in front of his door that she did not. So a red carpet mat in front of your door, no matter what time of the day is pretty noticeable, that all of a sudden there's a red carpet in front of your door and wasn't there the morning that you left your apartment. That should have been an indicator.
Let alone that, and correct me if I'm wrong, Liz, what little bit I've heard about this, but wasn't this individual's apartment like on one floor?
A different floor.
And she was on a total different floor. Now, I haven't heard how she got to those floors. Even if she walked and her apartment was on a lower level, that meant she walked additional floors incorrectly. Or if she got on the elevator, theoretically, the I guess you could, even though depending on how long you've lived there, I think by habit, you just push, the floor you live on.
The reasoning that we're told is that she worked a long shift.
It leaves us wondering how she even ended up at the wrong apartment on the wrong floor.
Well, I think that's going to, some of those things we're going to find out later. Mm-hmm. And by the way, and the officer, Amber Geiger, she was charged with manslaughter. From what I understand, a grand jury has been impaneled to investigate the case, in which could result in murder charges, from what how they work down there in Texas. But what really caught my attention, besides this initial situation where, oh my gosh, this guy gets shot and killed in his own apartment, is the apparently the police chief in Dallas wanted to start with some probable cause manslaughter charges right away. But the investigating agency was the Texas Rangers, who said, no, there's more information that we've just discovered that we want to. So we don't want to. We're not going to issue an arrest warrant just yet.
But I think Dallas police, didn't they actually, instead of doing the investigation themselves, they shifted it to the Rangers.
Which is, and that's something that is common for a department. Instead of investigating their own officer, they will have another agency.
And it was the Rangers who then came in with this manslaughter charge.
Yeah, and just to hold on. Yeah. But the fact that she was not detained right away, is interesting. And as a lot of protesters and folks have been pointing out, it's like, look, that's, if any one of us would have fired a gun and killed somebody,
been locked up right away.
In jail right away.
I mean, whose apartment is she going to go into next?
Right.
Or could she be a flight risk? I mean, and it's like I think there's an understanding that law enforcement officers are not, they're, talk about double standards. Right. I mean, because of, people look at them, well, they probably didn't do this on purpose. It was probably an accident. So we're not going to go after them like we would a criminal suspect in a homicide. Mm-hmm. And that seems to me like what that's impression is being given, that this officer is afforded certain privileges that somebody else who is not a police officer would be given. And so that's a big sticking point for a lot of people.
And given that ideology or idea, because I think that's tends to be kind of a common theme in these kind of circumstances. So in this country, that doesn't bode well. If, for instance, Botham John, let's imagine if he was white, all right, and this played out the same way. As an American, my concern is that we've allowed an institution to shoot first, and then the chips fall where they may, which means all of our lives are in jeopardy every time we come into contact with this institution. if they determine we're not going along with however it is they decide to treat
and
us
whether
at
or not
that
they're
given
on,
point in time.
Was this police officer on duty?
She was off duty, right?
She was in uniform.
Right. Yeah, so, I mean, it doesn't even matter if they're on duty, off duty, you know, everyone's at risk at any moment, it seems
well,
like.
Well, and officers are, I mean, and let's be real. I mean, officers are, they're humans,
yes.
right? They make mistakes.
Yeah.
And but again, when you study criminal cases, though, it's like you have to, obviously somebody's innocent until proven guilty. But when there's charges filed, prosecutors go after somebody because they want to, obviously their charges for to dispense justice. But a lot of prosecutors are looking to, if they want to find somebody who's committed a crime, they want to charge them to the fullest extent of the law. When police officers are at the center of these types of incidents, it just seems like there's a different standard that's being placed on that officer. And I've covered cases where officers have lied. They've lied. Like any human being who would try to cover their own tracks to make sure they don't get in trouble. That does happen. But it seems like there are prosecutors who are maybe not looking in
that direction. There's a corruption case going on in Baltimore right now where I've been reading where an officer has admitted to carrying a fake gun.
A plastic gun in order to drop
on a client if they happen to shoot and kill somebody.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, and those examples, Don and Brent, really are more common than we hear about. Having had someone in my family who actually litigated cases, police abuse cases, for over 25 years, where
in Minnesota,
okay, and lying and then being caught with the lie because of surveillance tapes that they were unaware existed by way of a closed circuit TV, you know, in the city, overlooking them, and they were unaware of that. Mm-hmm. And also having other evidence that was uncontroverted, meaning it was solid, right? There, and it was not tampered with. So that those examples exist here, and they exist elsewhere, and we have now with, you know, the prevalence of smartphones being able to see kind of the consumerism of the videos by lay people that also corroborate, you know, officers saying the offender may have brandished the gun at them, and then the videotape shows that the suspect was running away from them, right?
Mm-hmm. So
but when we get to that, the big issue here that is undergirding what all of you are saying, you know, May and Brandt and Don, is the issue of public trust.
Yes.
When you think about law enforcement, we live and expect to live in a society where law enforcement is there to protect and serve, not to harm. And that's what the oath is. And that's our expectation historically of what law enforcement should be. However, in situations like this with Botham John and the many others that we have talked about on our segments, there's a really deep erosion of that trust with the community. And at the very least, we know factually she pulled the trigger and shot and killed him.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever the circumstances were are left to be determined by either a juror, you know, on impaneled jury or grand jury or a judge, whomever, trier of fact. At the very least, though, she should have been taken into custody. And when you're not taken into custody, that just really erodes the public trust, but it also puts officers on a pedestal that they are held not only to a different standard, but to a standard that is not even an option for anybody else.
Mm-hmm. Right. And you see that in trials when an officer is put on trial. I've sat there during jury selection, and a common question put in front of jurors is, would you take the word of a police officer as being more truthful over someone who is not a police officer? And that's something that you have to, you know, ask anyone who's going to be, you know, judging the evidence in one of these trials. And often there are times when, and I've seen it go both ways. I've seen juries come back and convict officers for on-duty actions that mm-hmm. they did that rose to the level of a crime. And I've also seen officers acquitted by juries. But attorneys will tell you, it's like a lot of times people do give officers the benefit of the doubt mm-hmm. and feel that they are probably more truthful because it's in the nature of their job is to uphold the law. And you know, doing something like assaulting somebody or hiding evidence or that sort of thing is against the law, and they wouldn't normally do that.
And in yeah. this case, one of the intersections for me of this case and then maybe something that happened here in Minnesota mm-hmm. With the Justine shooting in South Minneapolis, where we have a reversal of the ethnicities of the individuals involved. And unfortunately, as a person of color in the United States, I can't help but look at that intersection, where these different ethnicities have come together in these tragic events, and not only how they're played out in media, but eventually how they're going to play out in courts. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, in this country, we've had many results where when that intersectionality involves an officer from the white race and a person of color as the victim, time after time after time, we've seen where many of us feel an injustice, Philando Castile, for mm-hmm. instance. Mm-hmm. And so this, you know, to watch these both play out is going to be tremendous. It's going to be an experience to see how this plays out in Dallas.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And how it plays out here.
Yeah. Well, it's that dissonance, right? Yeah. It's that the expectation is that it should all work out the same yes. way, right? Mm-hmm. That the treatment should be the same. And so yeah. in terms of fairness and equity, if A plus B equals C in Dallas, it should be A plus B equals C in Minneapolis mm-hmm. and everywhere else. However, given what we've seen, that's not the case.
But yeah. that's what they mm-hmm. taught us in school and yep. in our Western education. They taught us that A plus B equals C, right? But we very seldom see it play out like that. And so this is going to be very interesting to see how this mm-hmm. plays out.
And I feel that I should always make a disclaimer that we're not labeling all law enforcement.
Yes.
Right?
By all means.
Have actually 5 relatives who are in law enforcement. So, you know, I speak not with... I don't think any of us speak with yes. a broad brush.
Yeah. No.
But similarly, just, you know, isolating mm-hmm. these instances that we're talking about, but that it's prevalent enough around the country and over time that there is a pattern mm-hmm. That we are concerned yeah. about.
And it's interesting that we take this additional step to make that known when... The flip side, historically in this country, when a member of our group does something wrong, mm-hmm. then society paints our entire group with that same brush. But we still find it necessary to have to offer this explanation that we're not painting. I just thought I needed to point that out. Mm-hmm. Because we do. We're not painting all police officers.
Right.
But we are talking about those intersections, and we're talking about the fact that now that with social media, with smartphones, mm-hmm. almost every day we're being bombarded with an incident right. somewhere in this country where all these intersections are coming together and how they play out.
And it's mm-hmm. I think it's important just because also I've spoken with police officers who feel like they are – like under siege as far as mm-hmm. public opinion towards police officers and feel like, you know, they get in their cars and they...
Now they know what people of color feel like.
Well, exactly. Yeah. You know, this is in the... And I'm just saying that, you know, when it comes to, you know, their perceptions, if they feel like everybody else is after them, We don't want to foster, you know, what I'm saying is like we're all in this conversation, and so we're trying to make sure that we're treating everybody.
I understand. Yep. They carry gun. We don't.
Exactly. Mm. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. And I'm not saying that, you know, I'm definitely not defending them that way. I'm just telling you what officers tell me.
Right.
And that, you know, it's like what they're feeling and that right. they feel like, whether it's just or unjustly feeling that right. way. Right. But I'm just saying there's an us against them mentality that seems to be, and it may have been since time immemorial. Mm-hmm. Before, you know, right. since police first started patrolling.
But it's really a systemic
or
kind
slave
of problem,
catchers started
really.
Catching.
It's bigger than that.
Yeah, yep. absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, folks, it's been another interesting conversation. May, it's been great having you join us. We invite you back. The door is always open. And with that, thank you for another engaging conversation. And we'll see you next time. My name is Luz Maria Frias.
Don Eubanks.
May Esperanza Los Loso.
Brant Williams.
We'll see you next time.
This was a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to our discussion, you can call in at 800-242-2828 or tweet Kerri at @KERRINPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all of our shows by subscribing to this podcast. If you have questions, you can email us at talk@npr.org.